Well, Dr. Barbara Oakley's new book, Cold-Blooded Kindness, maybe proposes that in reverse. Can you be kind and end up being cruel? Or what cruelty does kindness mask would be another way of asking it. She's an associate professor of engineering at Oakland University in Michigan. She's the author of Evil Genes: Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend. This new book takes us into a very interesting place, into the story of one woman who killed, but what we can learn from her and what we all need to know about that weird, cruel kindness paradox coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Bunnett. So it's such an interesting proposal you have, and something which I think will be kind of a paradigm shift for a lot of people listening tonight. Good evening, Dr. Barbara Oakley.
Well, good evening, Ian. It's so great to be back on.
Well, you're fabulous. And let me ask you before we get into the new book, what's the disposition these days on the old book? People can still order Evil Genes?
Oh, absolutely. It's done so well. You would think that, I mean, it's got this ironic tongue-in-cheek title.
Right.
Evil Genes, Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My mother's Boyfriend. And she really did steal my mother's boyfriend.
Right. But, it's one of my favorite parts of the book. It's really, it's very funny. I mean, in a sad sort of way. I'm sorry, but that was interesting.
Well, yeah, it was kind of sad, but actually quite funny. But it has received so much critical praise that I'm just shocked. So it's
doesn't surprise me. I'm not shocked. I'm glad it's still in print and people can grab it. And so what is lately, I mean, let's talk about the proposal you make in Evil Genes, and then we'll find out how that may or may not inform cold-blooded kindness. But if you had to sum up your thesis easily for Evil Genes, what would it be?
That we know that somehow biophysiological influences make people do bad things, just the way they're wired. Some people are naturally, in part through their genetic predisposition, bad people. Of course, the environment also matters in there. But in the past, it's long been thought that it's just society that creates a really awful person. And that is simply not true. And this is one of the first books that tries to address why nasty people do the kinds of nasty things they do, and it draws from science to do that instead of just psychobabble.
Right. And that notion is discomforting to some people because they'd like to think that there are no bad people, just, you know, like there are no bad dogs, there's just bad owners, people who have raised them wrong, and only because of that or because of certain fluke influences, otherwise good people who can be rehabilitated go bad. And yet you take a bolder position that says, no, there's just some people who are just bad.
Absolutely. Well, it's clear from imaging evidence that some people have brains that function differently. And some of these people are actually, they're considered to be perfectly normal people. They can rise higher in any kind of social hierarchy that you've got, and they can be really nasty. You may wonder, well, how on earth could somebody do the kinds of things that person is doing, your boss, your malevolent sister,
right,
or whoever? And part of that arises from just a strange wiring or and I'm simplifying a whole bunch. But
sure you are.
It arises, you think that they're making the conscious choices that they're making to do these awful things, and they really are. But if you were wired the same way, you would probably be making the same conscious choices.
Yeah, a propensity for making bad choices. And they have sort of a genetic blueprint, which if you were to look at it as a schematic, for them to not make a bad choice would be the harder of the two things. They'd have to really focus, perhaps, and really concentrate on what would a good person do under these circumstances, as opposed to following the path of least resistance that they have.
Absolutely. Well, one of the issues that's really not understood in these kinds of cases is how important narcissism is to why a person acts the way they do. If you're really narcissistic, and that actually it's been shown to have one of the strongest genetic influences narcissism has. But if you are strongly narcissistic, you can pretty much justify any kind of bad behavior on your own part, because it's all for a good cause, right? It's for you.
Right. It's to celebrate you. And that's where what percentage do we think of our society might be inclined to be narcissist? Do we have data like that, or is it impossible to tell?
Well, I will be able to answer that question a lot better in about a year and a half, because my next two books relate to narcissism.
Okay, good. Well, that'd be interesting, because I think that's where, I do think there's a lot of narcissists in offices. You know, a lot of, you know, these are your garden variety narcissists that are in families, and they're not hurting anybody. They're not making the news. They're not doing anything. They're just making things difficult for everybody around them.
Absolutely. Well, there's one narcissist that I know, and I was so surprised. I thought, you know, this guy is a nice guy narcissist. And so I thought, wow, they're not all bad. And then he was indicted.
Okay, well, there goes that. There was that theory. So again, we're talking with the Dr. Barbara Oakley. And Barb, your new book is Cold Blooded Kindness. So how did your work in Evil Genes inform your discussion here on cold-blooded kindness? We'll get into more details on that in a minute.
Oh, well, I often got questions from people. They said, well, we can buy the idea that maybe Hitler had some poor wiring up there, and that was possibly what led him to make those kinds of horrific choices that he made. But what about all the rest of the Germans? They weren't all bad people. And, you know, that's really true. And I thought quite a bit about that. And I also used to work as a translator on Soviet trawlers. So I still remember I worked with these wonderful Russian communists, of course. And they truly believed in their system. And they thought their system was the best in the world. And it really, true communism is a very altruistic system.
Right.
But I saw all around me the decay of the Soviet Union, and I saw how afraid these people were. And from seeing that, I got the idea that you can really intend to do very good things and have them turn out to be horrific for everyone involved. So those kinds of things all played in the background while I was considering what my next book was going to be. Now you cannot tell my boss this at work, because I'm supposed to be just a normal engineering professor. But Friday nights, there's nothing I like better than curling up with a National Enquirer and the Globe. I love
that. Oh, sure. No, I'm all over that. No apologies here.
And so I was reading along, and I came across a story of Carol Alden, who had, as the story said, had killed this her husband, who had been attacking her, and she was so afraid that he was coming charging right straight towards her, and so she shot him, and it was only to save her own life that she had done this killing.
Right.
I thought, well, golly, this looks like a really a good person who was roped into doing a very bad act because of her own kindness. And I thought, well, gee, that seems like the perfect story to frame the ideas that I'm thinking about, because I like to examine the science, obviously, but I love stories. So I want to bring stories into this. And I thought, gosh, this is the perfect story. So I went out and started examining things. I talked to the prosecutors in the state of Utah and to Carol's people who knew Carol well, people who knew Marty well, and I really
her dead husband.
Right. Her husband was Marty Sessions, who was he was an ex-con. He wasn't an angel, that's for sure. But what I found was just it seemed like every day for about a year, I was peeling an onion back, and I find these shocking new revelations that would cause me to step back and reevaluate everything I'd done. And this was like every day. It was the most interesting and kind of a little bit of a spooky experience that I've ever had, because she's well, as the book reveals, she's not quite what she seems in the National Enquirer.
Well, and so explain this a little bit, the story behind Carol Alden and her husband, and why you think this is a such a four-star example of killer codependency.
Well, to my mind, what Carol was doing, she's the mother of five, ostensibly a very loving mother. That's what you hear from her children, and or at least some of her children. And she took in animals. In fact, she was almost near a pet hoarder. I mean, she would get these animals, and sometimes she would treat her animals better than she would treat her children. She would move the animals from or move her kids from a sunny bedroom down to a lower room that was much smaller, just so she could put hedgehogs in the room. I have to tell you this story. So she also wanted emu chicks. Emus.
Right. Okay. Just want to make sure. Right. You don't hear that word very often. I use it in Scrabble all the time, but you don't hear a lot of people else talking about emus. So right.
No, not very often at all. But she'd wanted to get some emus. That was to join her menagerie of animals. But emus are really expensive. And so this is what she did. I'm sort of shocked at this. She went and her 13-year-old daughter, as it turned out, got a lump on her breast. And before they actually knew anything about what it was, it turned out to be utterly benign. She went to all the newspaper reporters and told them that her daughter was dying, or she did it in this very subtle way. She would imply that her daughter was dying of malignant breast cancer. And then she said, and her dying wish is to have an emu chick.
Oh, and, come on.
And so what did the newspapers do? They fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. So next thing you know, she's got these emu chicks that are, and we're talking $10,000 worth of emu chicks by the time you add up the cost of the chick and getting it there and so forth. She's got these emu chicks donated to her. And it's not just that they were donated to her. All these journalists were lining the wall of the airport and taking pictures as the emu chicks arrived and all of the. It's just she pulled the wool over the eyes of the journalists, and it worked. She got her emu chicks. Oh, well, actually, ostensibly it was for her daughter.
Right.
Her daughter says, well, I really did want to have emu chicks. And you want to say, yes, but you weren't dying of malignant breast cancer.
You are participating in the charade. If you say, well, I really did want them, that's fine. But and then what is she? Well, you mentioned that she was kind of an animal hoarder. Emus grow pretty big, right? I mean, they're like ostriches, aren't they?
Oh, they do. She had a sort of a set of acreage out in Delta, Utah, and that's where she kept her animals. In fact, when the killing occurred, the officers came out there, and then they had to, some of them had unfortunate run-ins with the goat, which was butting them. But after the murder, well, when they arrived at the scene of the crime, and I'm going to describe this But it's actually, it's only the topmost layer of everything that was actually going on.
We're talking about Carol Alden, and she is, she in, apparently, or at least reacting to this in kind of a self-defense, tells the story of the shooting of her husband.
Precisely.
Okay, so this is the first layer of the, before we peel back what was really happening.
Yes. And so, okay. So the police arrive. Now, here's what they find, that she had taken her husband and she had shot him while he was in the hallway. Now, she claimed that she had shot him as he was charging straight towards her, but the bullet was in his back. Okay, so then there was a second bullet. So after she had shot him the first time in the back, he's lying there with arms outstretched, and she says, I was afraid he was going to get up again and he was going to kill me. And so that's when she went around him, got a pillow, took it back, put it up against his head, and then shot him through the pillow, shot him directly through the top of his head.
Right.
As the forensic autopsy individual said, it was a coup de grace. There was no chance for him after that.
Okay.
He was dead. So then she tied a rope around his body and tied it to the Jeep, and then dragged his body, it's like flailing around, through the house and took out the back stanchion on the porch, and the body comes flying out into the backyard. So then she goes out and she spends a lot of the night or the morning digging a hole under the koi pond where she's going to bury this guy. And then she makes the one single mistake of the whole thing. She called her boyfriend and said, can you help me bury the body? And he's like, are you nuts? I'm not going to help you bury the body. I'm going to call the police. So he calls the police immediately after, and this is like 12 hours or more after the murder is what it's looking like.
Right.
She calls the police, and then she says, well, gee, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. But when the police investigate, they find that she had bought the gun that very day, and she'd driven 100 miles south to avoid letting people know that that's what she was doing. And then, I was just appalled by this. So she in the National Enquirer article, she says, oh, my husband was this horrible man, and he was brutalizing me. He was torturing me, and he actually pierced my genitalia, and she cried in court when this was revealed because she was so embarrassed, but she couldn't do anything about it. Well, guess what? Turns out she was actually known as the Queen of Sadomasochism of Salt Lake City. So, and in fact, as it turned out, there were even witnesses that came forward that were found that said she had shown off her piercings to them. She was proud of them. So what this woman is being is something like a professional victim. She's taking advantage of that victim role that we give to people in society. We give them sort of a special privileged place. And she's using that for her own benefit. And that's what the book is about.
And so we'll get down to it then coming up. The unique relationship in codependency, why people stay in these relationships, what it was that she was getting out of it, but also the fact that on the surface, she presents as this very lovely person who's great to her family, kind of a pillar of the community type, a victim of an overbearing husband that so many people could relate to, and a protector of animals. And that's the image that she had until you find out that it really was a kind of cold-blooded kindness And we'll get into that in more detail coming up with Barb next. Again, Dr. Barbara Oakley, you can link up to her through coasttocoastam.com, as you can with all of our guests, Tracy Twyman on earlier and Dr. Catherine Ramsland. So you'll hear, well, as Uncle Paul would have said, the rest of the story next on Coast to Coast. Cold-blooded kindness. That's the theory here. That what percentage of people who on the outside present as very kind people, but that actually masks something really dark, and that you might even be in relationship with them right now and not know it till it's too late. We'll talk about that kind of killer kindness next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. You can link up with the cold-blooded kindness by going to our website at coasttocoastam.com. Barb, we were just talking about the story of Carol Alden. Let's put that on hold for the moment and just talk sort of broader strokes. So as you say, you kind of went into it looking for one thing, but you came out of it looking at something else again. What do you know now about codependency that you didn't understand before?
Well, one of the things that I did to give a scientific underpinning to what I was studying was I put together an edited volume for Oxford University Press that dealt with, so what I could do is I could ask some of the top scientists in the world to do article or do chapters on issues like codependency and so forth. And I have to say, just so that people don't think just because I like the National Enquirer that I don't know my science, because Edward O. Wilson, the Pulitzer Prize winner, wrote, "What a wonderful book. This is one of the few books in evolutionary biology I've read in the last 10 years that taught me something completely new." And so these kinds of scientific issues that relate to issues like codependency are very important to be studied. And they haven't been studied so far. And what I found was something really interesting. If you look at how the brain works, the left and right hemispheres are quite different in how they perceive the world. In fact, if you anesthetize one side or another, you'll have utterly different perceptions of the world. And they found that people who have split brain, because of epilepsy, they sometimes split the corpus callosum, which connects the two halves of the brain. And people who have this will do very unusual things sometimes. For example, they might be reaching with their right hand for a blue dress in the closet, and their left hand will come up, knock the right hand out of the way, and reach for the green dress. So it's as if we have two different wills within ourselves that, even though we only have one consciousness, we do have two separate wills. And so what one scientist has done, Simon Baron-Cohen, he's found that people often have a tendency towards either the right brain or the left brain. Right is more associated with general looking out at others. So it is more related to empathy. And people can be more right brain and empathetic. Left brain is associated more with systemizing and with people being able to solve analytic problems. So engineers, for example, are often far more left brain oriented. So what does this have to do with codependency? The issue is, if you're more right brain, like a lot more right brain, and you're not very left brain, what can happen is you are extremely empathetic, extremely, and yet you can't, you may not have good analytic skills. Now, if you have the opposite of this, if you're really more left brain oriented, what we've found is, or what is hypothesized, is the more left brain you are oriented, the more you can, you kind of tend a little more towards Asperger or, in the extreme, autism. So we've studied those quite a bit. we really have studied that. But we haven't studied the right brain, the extreme right brain. That may well be related to codependency. So I think this whole area is fascinating, and it has very little scientific study to it. And I think that's part of why so many millions of people buy books on codependency, because they're trying to help themselves, because science isn't stepping in there to help them.
Well, that's a very interesting theory. And for people who are not quite certain what codependency means, give an example, somebody in a relationship, they might be, they might seek an abuser, if only subconsciously, because they more easily identify with the role of a victim, and they have to almost be a victim of something in order for them to know who they are. And so they may seek out abusers, and abusers may be able to also then, they have a codependency. They have somebody who they can abuse, who then also won't tell outside the relationship, for example. And so they both kind of need each other in kind of a sick sort of way. Is that a fair example of codependency?
That's a perfect representation of codependency. They do support one another. A codependent can do things like, well, gee, my daughter's addicted to heroin, so I'm going to go off and I'm going to buy her heroin for her to make sure it's clean and she's taken care of in that way. It's a little bit better quality heroin.
Because that's the kind of mom I am.
That's right.
Right.
And it isn't, but oftentimes it's not quite so obvious that you're helping someone who's maybe got a drug addiction or a problem of some sort. And you're actually sometimes gaining a little power and control through your codependent, quote unquote, help of that person.
Right. I mean, and the typical say of an alcoholic codependency is somebody that keeps the alcoholic drinking, even if they're, say, not an abuser, just because, for example, they might want to be the saver. They know themselves as the person who comes in and swoops in and saves the day, and somebody who's got a drinking problem needs a lot of saving. And so they're able to think of themselves as the put-upon person who is always coming in and always trying to make it right, when really they're just setting themselves up for those circumstances, and they're getting their own buzz out of it. They just don't do it consciously.
That's exactly right. Well, one thing that it's very interesting with codependency. I mean, this is something where people do get help, or they feel good out of that. But also, there can truly be codependent relationships where, at least I believe it's the case, where people are so empathetic with another, they really truly believe that they're helping, and they simply don't have the wherewithal to step back and rationally look at what they're doing and realize that it isn't helping.
Well, a similar argument has been made, and maybe this is at the core of pathological altruism, the name of your Oxford University Press study, right? Am I getting that right?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so pathological altruism, a lot of people would argue that a lot of our social structures, a lot of our, say, part of our welfare system, it's maybe well-intended, it may be from a good place, but it ends up perpetuating of the problem. It ends up creating kind of a victim class who never are able to break out of it because the rules on how to receive this this aid end up almost sort of guaranteeing that a high percentage of these people will never get off of that aid.
That's true. An example that I sometimes give, I really care about having minorities in my engineering classroom. So I went into the local Pontiac school district and brought a math program, and I worked there for 5 years, brought Kuhlman mathematics, and the program worked fantastic. And then what happened was I caught them cheating, essentially. And I reported them to the state. And so, of course, I I was immediately kicked out of the school district. And people generally, researchers are not allowed into that school district from what I've heard because, well, they don't want other people to do what I did, which I discovered that no matter how good my program was, this math program, there were schools in that inner urban school district that had 98 or 99 percentile scores for their students on the statewide math examination. So of course, what I found out was the administrator told me that he had been giving results to or giving some of the test solutions and the tests themselves to the elementary schools before the test was actually administered. So they could basically jimmy the results. So what all this is leading to is I really, really care about inner urban school districts and that they are very successful. Now, one program that we had that was meant to help people in inner urban school districts was busing. We devised busing to help reduce segregation, to help improve the school system, the types of education that people were getting. Now, of course, the parents had little say-so. Their child would be forced to go to some school or another. The upshot of this program, which was enormously expensive, was that a lot of well-to-do parents simply moved out of the inner urban school districts.
White flight.
And so, for example, in places like Detroit, it worsened the segregation that was already present. So this well-meaning program that was really supposed to help people, in the end, actually just worsened the whole situation and at enormous cost. So it's these kinds of things as well. It isn't just codependency on an individual level. There's a sort of an equal codependency on a national and even an international level. Not that helping other people is a bad thing. It's a really good thing. But you have to use rationality as well as emotion and also realize when people are stringing you along, playing you, yes, we must have busing, that you're a racist or whatever if you're against this. And yet they themselves are the ones who are really benefiting from these types of programs.
You know, that's a difficult thing for some people to take. And yet I think the point is you're making eloquently is that there's a science to this. There's an underpinning of science to this that says that things have to produce results that are in accordance with what the original intent of the program was. And a lot of people get so over invested in the empathy of it that they don't see how much they are, how much cruelty they're creating in their kindness. And they begin just sort of, as you mentioned, almost sort of neurologically, they are unable to see it. They filter it out because they're so focused on we're the caring ones, so we could never be responsible for that. We're the people who care. Look at what we're doing. And they put on blinkers to the idea of what's actually happening.
Well, that's so true. The main point that I bring out in Cold-Blooded Kindness and also in Pathological Altruism is that altruism isn't this sacred holy relic that if you do something altruistic that is helpful for others, sometimes at a cost for yourself, that does not necessarily mean you're actually doing something good. In fact, pulling our altruistic heartstrings is often how we can ourselves want to do things that are really horrific. And that seems hard to understand.
Yeah, explain that. What do you mean? What would be horrific that we do because we think we're doing the right thing? What do you mean by that?
Genocide. When people, let's say the Hutus and the Tutsis.
Right.
So a Hutu doesn't wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to be so extraordinarily evil today. I'm going to go out and I'm going to kill a Tootsie, right? No, what they're thinking is, I'm going to help my fellow Hutus by killing those cockroaches. They're not even humans. So the in genocide, often it's the altruistic. It's your care for those who surround you, who you think are real people because the others aren't.
Right.
That can help lead you so that you want to hurt other people.
Well, that brings it right back to the Hitler example you gave earlier. Hitler may have been a victim, or sorry, genealogically speaking, of evil genes. He might have gotten, you know, a bad throw of the dice, genetically speaking, but there, for the millions of Germans that went along with it, they had to have been manipulated on another basis, and you're hitting on it there, if I'm not missing my guess, by saying that they thought what they were doing was very positive. They were doing something, say, to come to the aid of those Germans who were in the Sudetenland, or they were coming to the aid of Germans or to like-minded people everywhere who are being unfairly, persecuted in these other countries, and that are going to create a better place for everybody when we're done.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. It always is under the guise of, we're helping. We're helping others. It's amazing. Well, one thing that shocked me was, there were some very well-placed individuals at the National Academies of Science who warned my colleagues and I that the book Pathological Altruism would not be well received by some very prominent and very powerful academics. And I thought, oh, come on. You know, that's a conspiracy theory. And, of course, what I found, though, was that I was a very altruistic friend nominated me for the New York Academy of Medicine. And so I was inducted in. I'm, like, the only engineer in the New York Academy of Medicine. So what happened was, when I was going to the induction ceremony, there was this speaker there, and he was just fantastic. And he talked about the great work of the Academy, and he just sounded like the nicest person you could ever hope to meet. So afterwards, my friend brought me up to this fellow and introduced me and said, oh, by the way, she's editing a book called Pathological Altruism. Well, my goodness, you would have thought that I had just grown horns. He wheeled on me and he goes, pathological altruism. Pathological altruism. Altruism can never be pathological. And he goes on to a tirade about how altruism is always a great thing. And then before I could even open my mouth, he wheeled and with his entourage was out the door. And that's the kind of thing I believe that the well-placed people at the National Academies were talking about. This instantaneous, you're wrong. Altruism always has to be good.
Right.
And that's actually not true at all. We need to be much more open about accepting that some people can claim that they're doing something to help others, but it's really not true, and that even well-meaning acts can sometimes have exactly the opposite effect of what they were intended.
Well, if there was an opposite, an antonym maybe for pathological altruism, it might be tough love, because a lot of people do that to excess too. They think, as long as I'm being tough, I'm loving. But it has to be a balance of those two things. And yet, you know, some people get upside down in just how tough they can be to show love. And that's not a pure answer in and of itself. Well, it's with this as a background, then, cold-blooded kindness, that we'll get back to the story. It's a true story of a murder, which was originally thought to be merely, and I emphasize that, an act of self-defense by a Utah housewife living with an abusive husband. But as Barbara Oakley continued to investigate the story, she found that, in fact, it was something very, very different, something much darker, and something which tells us a lot more about the human experience. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.